This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and editor-at-large of Yes Magazine. Sarah writes and speaks internationally on environmental, social, and economic alternatives and on community-based change. Sarah Van Gelder is here to tell us about her most recent book, The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile Journey Through a New America, published in 2017. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks so much for having me, Diane.
It's great to have you here. Would you like to begin by saying a few words about Yes Magazine?
Sure. We're a quarterly magazine and website. We were founded 20 years ago, and the purpose of Yes is to tell stories about how people are changing the world, starting from their community and in all other ways.
Now let's move on to your book. What led to your 12,000-mile journey through America? What was your purpose?
So after 20 years of editing Yes Magazine, we had been looking at some of the big challenges of our time, things like climate change, things like racism, things like growing inequality. And as much as we'd been writing about solutions all that time, I still had the sense that, you know what, things are still getting worse. Are we looking in the right place for solutions? So I decided to go on the road for myself to see what I could learn by going to communities that have been left out of some of the benefits of society, especially people in the red states, people in Appalachia and on Indian reservations and in the South and in the Rust Belt cities. And I wanted to see what I could learn from them about where change might be coming from.
What were some of the specific questions you were hoping to answer as a result of the trip?
Well, around the climate question, one of them was, who is successful at stopping more fossil fuel from being extracted and transported? And especially here in the Pacific Northwest, there's been a lot of controversy about exporting coal and oil and building new infrastructure to export fossil fuels to Asia. So why are we building new fossil fuel infrastructure at a time when the climate is in crisis? So I was looking for people who are succeeding in stopping that from happening. And in this region in particular, and in several places I visited, it's groups of people led by Native Americans who are having the most success. So that was one question. A second one was about inequality, because there's certain communities that are so left behind. What are they doing to build a new economy? And the third was about racism, because a lot of people, I think, had hoped that when President Obama was elected, that things would be better, that we would somehow have gotten past our horrible legacy as a country of racism. And obviously that didn't occur. So what I was looking at was, are there communities that have taken this on in a deep and profound and forthright way and really made a shift in the culture to move away from racism?
How did you decide which people and places to visit? What were your criteria?
Well, I was looking for people who had answers to those questions. So some of the time they were places I'd been curious about for a long time that I just never had a chance to go to. For example, in Appalachia, I'd almost never been there and never been there to do any reporting. And other places, they were places I had been to before, and I just wanted to catch up and see what was happening more recently. Detroit, Michigan is one of them. I go back periodically because there's such a creative upwelling happening in Detroit. I just always want to learn what's going on there now. So it was a combination of people I knew and people I didn't know, many of whom were referred to me by other people who got on my social media and said, you know, you ought to check this out. This is really exciting.
Well, you've said a bit about this already, but what hopeful steps did you observe being taken to address climate change?
Well, here in the Pacific Northwest, there are people like the Lummi tribe who have been standing up to, in this case, the big coal terminal that was proposed for north of Bellingham. And that got me wondering, well, where was all that coal going to come from that they would need an entirely new international coal terminal? So I traced it back to southeast Montana, where there was a proposed brand new strip mine that would have been the largest coal mine in the entire state of Montana. So I went there. I actually got my little truck camper and drove to southeast Montana and talked to the Northern Cheyenne people who were opposing that brand new proposed strip mine. And also talk to the ranchers out there, because it turns out they didn't want that mine either, and they didn't want the brand new railroad spur that would have to be built to connect all that coal with this long railroad that would then end up in Bellingham and then be exported to Asia, where literally hundreds of thousands of people are sickened by burning all that coal. Not that coal, but coal in general. So I went there, and I happened to be able to time my visit for when the Lummi tribe was arriving in southeast Montana with a totem pole they were giving as a gift to the Northern Cheyenne people. So there is this wonderful solidarity among the coastal tribes, the inland tribes, and the ranchers that in the end succeeded in stopping that coal mine from going through.
What are some of the efforts to address racism that you observed on your trip?
You know, it's interesting because they happen in many different ways in many different parts of the country. One that I thought was especially interesting was Ithaca, New York, because, you know, a lot of people assume that in the North that the problems with racism are not as profound, and in small towns maybe not as profound. And Ithaca is a predominantly white community, but they also realized, or a number of people in the town realized, that they really had not come to terms with their own issues around race. So I had a chance to interview a couple who do a theater project. He's African-American, she's white, and they do a theater project where they draw stories from the community of things that have happened to people. And then they write plays that are tuned into them. Of course, they fictionalize them, but are tuned into those particular stories. So the play that I talked to them about in particular was one in which a young African-American, a middle schooler, was walking through a neighborhood. He missed his bus. He was trying to walk to school, walked through a white neighborhood, and an elderly white woman called the police on him. And he's just mystified. Why is it that in the 21st century that just me being out on the street would be enough to provoke a police action? And fortunately, nothing bad happened. The police officer found out he was lost and took him to school. So there was no tragedy in this particular story. But not that long ago, somebody had had a gun pulled at him, an African-American young person, for being in the wrong place at the wrong time by an off-duty police officer. So clearly, these are stories that are profoundly troubling and that communities all over the country need to deal with. And so by putting it into the form of a theater production, this town was able to have that conversation in a way that was deeply relevant to their particular circumstances.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and editor-at-large of Yes Magazine, and author of the book, The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile Journey Through a New America. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. Are there additional examples of addressing racism you'd like to share?
Oh, sure. All over the place. One is in Harrisonburg, Virginia, where the police department is starting to find ways of using restorative justice to deal with questions of crime, rather than assuming that everything that happens ought to be subject to the most punitive kinds of responses. Another was in Greensboro, North Carolina, which is where the original sit-in happened at the lunch counter, the Woolworth's lunch counter, that provoked a big chunk of the civil rights movement around the sit-ins to desegregate restaurants and so forth, and where there's a continuing effort in that community to have that kind of conversation to say, what do we need to do to come together? And in this particular case, the Black community, a number of leaders in the Black community decided what they really needed to do was to form their own food co-op so they would have an ownership stake in their community. And from that basis of health and of power, of being owners of this food co-op, they would be in a better position to navigate their community.
How effective have these efforts been, in your view?
It's an interesting question because I think a lot of us had hoped, you know, one big act like the election of a new president or like the right demonstration or the right leader making the right ringing speech would somehow solve things. And it turns out that's not the way things happen. They happen more incrementally. They happen when people are involved themselves in these kind of conversations and where they see how they can make shifts in their own communities that change the way the institutions function, change the way rewards are given or not given for certain kinds of activities. In Greensboro, there was a big question raised by a big New York Times article about why communities of color were being stopped more often than white people. And that publicity and this follow-up in terms of activism, all of those things together bring about a shift, along with the change in generations and the change in culture as people come to understand and appreciate each other better. So I don't think you can say that any one thing kind of flips the switch on something as profound and as complex as racism, but they're all part of the puzzle, and they're all part of us making a commitment to take another step forward every single day to change things like that.
What were some of the inspiring efforts being made to confront poverty and build sustainable economies?
Yeah, that's a really tough one. I visited some communities, especially in the Rust Belt, where poverty has been multi-generational, where there are entire communities that have been left out, where people simply don't have jobs. There are no businesses to speak of, much less jobs. So those places are incredibly tough. And I interviewed a doctor in Cincinnati, Ohio, Dr. Garza, who's a pediatric surgeon. He had to tell a mother of a young child who'd been shot, you know, he had to tell her that she was not going to live. And the only way he could be okay in himself was to also make the commitment that he was going to do everything he could to make sure he'd never have to tell another mother that her child had been killed. So he's been one of the people in Cincinnati who's been busily working on the question of how do you create an economy that's founded in the community. It's a very different approach than trying to bring in a large corporation who might be willing to bring in a bunch of jobs, and you end up spending a ton of money per job to get them to do that. But you don't know if next year or 5 years from now they're going to pick up and go to someplace else that offers them even more money or even lower wages and working standards. So this technique is about building jobs from the community up. And they're doing this in Cincinnati in a very interesting way, involving the labor unions and worker co-ops and working with small business owners and saying, why not, when you're ready to retire, why not sell your business to the workers so they can own it and continue having jobs themselves and continue helping to allow the community to thrive. In many cases, their workers may be people who don't come from backgrounds where they would have had another opportunity to own a business. The unions are getting involved, helping to provide skills and expertise, and they're also teaming up with the Mondragon Cooperative in Spain, which is one of the most successful cooperatives in the world with thousands of people on their payroll. So they're working out some really new ideas for how do you have an economy that is profoundly rooted in the community and is democratic in the way it's run.
Would you also speak about efforts in Appalachia to develop a post-coal economy?
Yeah, that's another really tough one because, as we know, that coal has been the foundation of that economy for so long. You know, there was a time when people did a lot more that was about self-sufficiency, growing a lot of their food and so forth, but the coal economy sort of took everything over. And now is not only creating a new spike in black lung disease, but also blowing the tops off mountains and filling the creeks and the rivers with debris. So it's a really tragic situation. And yet a lot of people there are convinced that they have no other alternative. So I spent a bunch of time with some of the young people in Appalachia who have a very different idea. Some of the people who are very attached to the coal economy, they've been saying the only other alternative is to build prisons. And Kentucky has one of the highest percentages of prisons anywhere in the United States. So I spoke to some of the people who are opposing the building of yet another prison on a mountaintop that had been leveled as part of mountaintop removal. And they said, you know what, if you took that same amount of subsidy, because the federal government, of course, is pouring millions of dollars into that, you took that same amount of subsidy and helped, you know, a dozen local businesses really get off the ground, you could provide jobs that weren't from correctional officers being brought in from outside, but for local people, local young people who want to stay in their community and want to stay where they are and be part of rebuilding Appalachia. So, you know, they're very brave young people who are working on things like bringing back Appalachian culture and getting people to enjoy their own music and go out in the evening and hear their own bands and go to the local restaurants. And those things seem small, but little by little, they're trying to keep their money flowing into their own culture instead of having it leak out of the district into Hollywood and Madison Avenue. Having it stay local is a really big part of that equation of rebuilding the economy.
What were some of the efforts you observed to help recent U.S. immigrants?
Well, actually, one of my favorite examples was immigrants helping themselves, which is a couple of immigrants from El Salvador and Honduras, respectively, who wanted to have food that was like what they were used to in Central America and decided to start growing it. So they started a little tiny farm, but then they realized that not only was it a lot of work, it was kind of lonesome just doing it on their own. So they started inviting other people to be part of a farm cooperative. So this was another part of Kentucky, just outside Louisville, Kentucky. And there were people of all races and ethnic backgrounds who were involved. And I happened to be there in time for their harvest festival. And there was so much joy there. People were having such a lovely time. They were working really hard at growing all that food that they were then harvesting and sharing among each other. But then there was this sense of just joy that they were learning from each other. They were experiencing different cultures. And they had this sense of community. And I was just so struck by how different that was than just going to Safeway or to Albertsons to buy your food.
Would you also comment on what you observed in Moab in regard to immigrants?
Sure. Moab, Utah, I visited a center, a multicultural center, that's also run by a Latina woman. You know, part of what they're doing is basically providing services to people who are recent immigrants who are drawn by the jobs, mainly in the tourist industry. But the other part of what they're doing is really helping the community understand each other better. So they put on these marvelous occasions, like they call one of them Dancing with the Moab Stars. So they pick on a bunch of community leaders from all different backgrounds, teach them how to dance, and get them to go up on stage and sort of make fools of themselves, but everybody's having a good time laughing at themselves. And they're building these bridges that wouldn't be built otherwise, because otherwise people would just stay in their separate worlds. So they're bringing a kind of a joy and a kind of a cross-cultural excitement to a little town that could otherwise be, you know, sort of physically very beautiful. Of course, it's right in the middle of all those national parks, but culturally it could be kind of drab, and they're really livening it up.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and editor-at-large of Yes Magazine and author of the book, The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-Mile Journey Through a New America. In your book, you refer to an emerging culture of connection. Would you explain?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the things that's happened to our society, and I think a lot about this now with the election of Donald Trump, I think we've gotten really isolated from each other. You know, a lot of people don't feel like there are other people that they can rely on who will help them out in times of need. There's even studies that show that the kind of isolation a lot of people experience is as toxic as smoking cigarettes or being obese. It's really bad for our health. And so one of the things I was looking for was, where are people doing something about that? And, you know, that story about the folks in Moab or the people in Kentucky who are reaching out to one another, just noticing how joyful they were. A lot of people say that doing community organizing or doing community work or working for the betterment of your society is just a drag and it's a drain. But what I found was the opposite. People were getting so much emotional nourishment from being connected to their community. So that's one piece of it. It's just the emotional side. Another is the connection to the natural world, because, you know, so many of us are separated from having that direct interaction with the natural world. And the environmental movement or environmentalism becomes something abstract that involves other people or polar bears or something. But the natural world is something we are part of every day. We breathe the air, we drink the water, we eat food that came right out of the soil. You know, the natural world is us. And to the extent that we reconnect with that in a deeply visceral sense and also in a spiritual sense, I think we get into a much better relationship where we can take much better care of it.
Well, to some extent, you've been alluding to this, but based on your trip, what did you see as the most powerful general strategies to build a sustainable future?
Well, I think we're in for a time of real difficulty with the election of Donald Trump. I don't think there's any way of getting around that question. And so I've been thinking a lot about what do we do now? And I happened to be out at Standing Rock when the election happened, and I remember climbing out of an icy tent early in the morning, hoping somebody was going to give me good news, but fearing for the worst. And I sat down right then and wrote a column about how important it is for us to reconnect where we are and reconnect especially with the people who are most vulnerable, to think of this election as like a natural disaster. And one of the first things you do when you know there are a lot of people at risk is you reach out to those people. You say, who's most vulnerable here? Is it a mosque? Is it people who are of Islamic faith? Is it new immigrant communities? Is it women? Is it Jews? Is it people who are speaking out politically? We don't really know who's going to get targeted first. We know that certainly Donald Trump has threatened all those people, and his followers have in some cases followed his advice and been quite violent towards those groups of people. So we know that those could all happen. So we shouldn't wait to see who's going to be victimized first. We should all get together and check in with each other and tell each other, I'll have your back, and will you have my back? And once we get that sense of connection in our community, I'm not talking about over social media, although social media is great for organizing, but actually coming together face to face and reconnecting, then we have the foundations for the kind of power we're going to need to keep our member of Congress accountable to us and not let them get swept up in the Trump agenda, and to get the things that we need done in our communities, to get those things done in spite of whatever Trump might do. So we can keep ourselves safe and we can find our power by that kind of reconnection in our community.
Does the revolution need to be where you live to be successful? How important is the role of place-based work?
Well, that was one of the things that I was really taken by in the traveling I did, was how much more power people have when they can stand on the moral authority of being from a place, and when they connect to other people in their community who have a similar passion. I think a lot of times we feel really powerless because we feel like, oh, it's me against whatever number, hundreds of millions of people in the whole country, or just me and this tiny group against all of those people. But when we start taking one bite at a time and say, we can actually do something in our communities and we can support one another, and then we can join up with other communities. One of the things that was so striking about Standing Rock and so powerful was it started off with one community, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, saying they were not going to allow that pipeline to go through. But they put out a call, and all sorts of other communities showed up. First tribal communities and then non-tribal communities showed up and said, okay, we're going to stand with you. As long as you're standing for this, we're with you. And I think that model just teaches us an enormous amount about how much we can do when we stand up for our place and stand with one another.
Would you say more about what the energy was like at Standing Rock?
Well, it was a place where I think a lot of people were in awe of what they were doing and what they were learning. People were, on the one hand, ready to put their bodies on the line. They were getting maced on a regular basis. Many were getting arrested. Many were getting hit with rubber bullets and concussion grenades. So on the one hand, it was a very arduous kind of experience for a lot of people. And on the other hand, there was this sense of mutual support and even love. And I was there one day when a young woman by the name of Lila June led a forgiveness walk into Bismarck, into Mandan, which is adjacent to Bismarck, to the sheriff's department, because she said, you know, we can't do this work in a good way if we're carrying anger with us. So the first thing we have to do is let go of that anger. And the best way we can do is do a march of forgiveness for the police, for the harm that they've caused. And so they did that. And they not only talked about forgiveness, they also prayed for the well-being of the police and the well-being of their families, and the hope that their children would be happy and healthy, and the hope that their children wouldn't have to drink polluted water, just like they didn't want their children to have to drink polluted water. It was a very moving occasion. And I think maybe it even got through to some of the police. I don't know.
Based on your trip, what are your thoughts on the state of U.S. society at present?
Oh, that's just a little question. Well, I think the isolation is a really important part of it. The isolation and powerlessness, and also the way in which that sense of disconnect from reality is allowing all these fake news and all this conspiracy theories. Not that there aren't real conspiracies out there, but I think people are getting a little unhinged from reality. And one of the ways you get recentered in what's real and regrounded in what's real is you get away from the screen, away from just hearing everything through media, and go and see for yourself in your own community who's out there. What are people saying? What are they thinking? And really listening to one another. So I think getting away from that isolation is going to be a really important part of how we can move forward.
Well, you've alluded to this already, but what effect do you see a Trump presidency having on the place-based work you observed on your trip?
Well, I think it makes it more important than it ever has been. I think there are new challenges we'll have now. If Obamacare goes away, we'll suddenly have many of our neighbors, and it could be any of us, who find ourselves without health care. If Trump follows through on his promises to allow the environment to be, you know, what he calls doing away with regulation, which you should translate as doing away with protections, right? So if all the protections that have kept our environment from becoming totally degraded, if those are allowed to be set aside and all of our beautiful natural spaces are turned into places that can be drilled and where pipelines can run and coal trains can, you know, we will have some major, major challenges on our hands. And I still think we will be in a much better position to deal with whatever comes if we know our neighbors and we have that kind of local power base wherever we are, where we know each other and we know how to stand up for ourselves.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Get active. Meet your neighbors. Don't be afraid. You know, in a time of fear, I think it's easy to hunker down and just withdraw and try to cocoon and stay inside. And I think that just causes more fear. So my message is get out of the house, get to know other people, find out what you have in common, and find out what gives you energy, what gives you joy, and do those things and keep at it until you create the kind of community that you want and the power from which you, as part of this big grassroots movement, can create the kind of world that we want together.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Sarah.
Thank you, Diane.
You are just listening to Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and editor-at-large of Yes Magazine, and author of the book, The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-Mile Journey Through a New America, published in 2017 by Barrett Kohler Publishers. To find out more, you are invited to join Sarah on Monday, January 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Elliott Bay Book Company. Again, that's 7 p.m. January 23rd at Elliott Bay Book Company. And also check on the web at revolutionwhereyoulive.org and yesmagazine.org. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening. And be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.